We're exploring the wolf population's effect on deer and connecting it to an economic benefit here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. So what if wolves were actually saving drivers' lives because wolves prowl along roadways, either hunt down deer, scare them back into the woods? What are the economics of reducing deer on car crashes? Join in with your thoughts on this theory and implications on the fraught wolf debate, 800-642-1234. Corbett Granger is an economist who studies environmental resource issues, associate professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and co-author of the study. It's called Wolves Make Roadways Safer, Generating Large Economic Returns to Predator Conservation. Corbett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. I'm happy to be here.
Well, tension's undeniable with your study and when you assert that wolves make our Wisconsin roads safer, keeping deer at bay. But then you look at, you know, over 35 years, Wisconsin has paid out nearly $3 million for wolf depredation, figures from the DNR stopping at April 2020, and that's compensation claims for wolves killing livestock, wolves killing the hunting dog. So give us your economic framework around wolves.
So I'll start off by saying that those losses are real and they are important and they're certainly something that we're cognizant of. But I think, you know, if you take those numbers and put them in perspective relative to deer vehicle collisions, in the U.S., the cost of deer vehicle collisions is about $10 billion per year. And in Wisconsin, there's about 20,000 per year, about 500 injuries, 8 fatalities, and about $200 million in losses. And again, that's an annual number. And so what we look at in the study is how does the reintroduction of wolves affect deer vehicle collisions? And we're able to do that by kind of going back in time, looking at the reintroduction of wolves, as they moved over space and kind of were reintroduced to different parts of the state, and then look to see how that changed the number of and frequency of deer vehicle collisions in those locations.
So you found that whenever wolves first entered a county in Wisconsin, the proportion of road accidents involving deer tended to fall. But how can you trace it back to wolves?
That's a really good question. So what we're doing in this paper is we're using some tools from econometrics. So economists have spent a lot of time and energy working on statistical models so that we can say something causal in kind of a messy environment. If you think of most of the types of things that economists study, they're not lab experiments, right? We're working with observational data, and so economists have developed a pretty complex and useful toolkit for being able to say something causally in an observational setting. And so we're able to control for a lot of, you know, factors that could be confounding, like cross-sectional differences, you know, differences between counties and deer vehicle collisions that are just kind of, that make one county different from the other. What we're doing is looking at kind of within county changes and then seeing how that plays out as wolves are introduced into new counties.
Why does Wisconsin data make it very realistic, or why is it good data to use from Wisconsin versus anywhere else?
Well, we used data from Wisconsin first and foremost because that's where we are, and so this is a, you know, obviously something that's near and dear to the people working here, but it actually is a pretty nice laboratory to look at this because wolves, you know, they were basically completely wiped out from the state, and then as they were reintroduced, it happened gradually. And so what we're looking at is kind of wolf entry into different Wisconsin counties over a span of about 22 years.
So, and I think I learned too that wolf research often takes place in national parks, which are these really controlled places out of way with human conflicts.
Sure.
So your data is, I guess, a more practical look at really how wolves are interacting with a more typical environment.
Yeah, at least an environment where humans come into play, right? So if you're studying them in national parks, speed limits are low. It's, you know, you don't have roads crisscrossing most of it just by design because we're trying to keep it wild. Here, you know, in Wisconsin, we've got roadways all over the place. It's kind of mixed use. We have farms, we have ranches, we have forests, we have cities. And so what we're able to do is kind of, you know, hold that framework constant and then kind of say, all right, what happens when wolves are reintroduced into areas that they used to be? And then what happens to kind of the prevalence of these deer vehicle collisions that are so costly?
Corbett Granger with us, an economist and UW-Madison professor of studies, environmental and resource problems. You can join in. Have you hit a deer with your car? How much did that situation cost you? How have you seen wildlife affect Wisconsin's economy? 800-642-1234. Susan is joining us from Westfield. Hi, Susan. What are your observations?
You know, my observation as somebody who drives the back roads to Adams to work and back every day is there are deer everywhere. And wolves are an incredibly important part of our ecosystem. They were here before us, and being allowing them all to be killed and poached, because frankly, that's what happened with quite a few of them, has left a new problem now where they're everywhere. There isn't a single morning or evening that I don't almost hit a deer. And I know that the problem is a lot worse because they allowed so many wolves to be harvested. And instead of looking at how that might affect our overall well-being here, it was just all about people like hunting wolves without any thought as to whether or not those wolves should be hunted.
Susan, thank you. Corbett, what do you make of Susan's observations on her commute?
So that's something that I hear from people from all over the state and really all over the country. We really have an overabundance of deer. Deer are really prominent. They're all over the place. I live in the western side of Madison, and I even see deer on my commute. And there's really just a few greenways where they can live. But I see them in my street. I see them, you know, even here in town, and definitely when you go up into more rural parts of the state, they're everywhere. Yep.
So why would wolves be more effective or more productive than human deer hunters out there at reducing the amount of deer vehicle collisions?
Well, deer hunting has been kind of the traditional policy lever for us to try to control the abundance of deer populations. But if you look at, you know, how effective it is, it's just a short time horizon that we allow the hunting. And what we find is that, you know, the hunters can't really replicate this effect of wolves because so much of what we find is actually a behavioral effect. So we find that that the reintroduction of wolves does lead to a big decrease in deer vehicle collisions, but that's not just through this mechanism of predation. It's not just that. It's not a mechanical relationship. Deer eat wolves. Wolves eat deer. Therefore, there are fewer deer to hit with cars. Most of it is actually a behavioral effect. So we can attribute about 75% of the effect that we find to what we call a behavioral effect, which looks like wolves are keeping deer away from open spaces where they're more vulnerable.
Yes. What is happening along those roadways? What are those? I mean, can you kind of set us up here as to what that confrontation is like with deer and wolves and along the roads?
That's a really good question, and we can't actually say too much about that given the data that we have.
Okay.
But there have been previous studies and, you know, and kind of casual observations will confirm that wolves do use kind of these open corridors to move kind of quickly and effectively between points. And so, so you can see them occasionally running along the edge of the forest, off of the roadway. And there have been studies that have tried to look at the impact of wolves on deer behavior, but they've been pretty localized and rely on things like collaring.
Yeah, one scientist suggested you need to measure how risk averse deer are, that you need to put GPS collars on wolves and deer and then learn if wolves change their prey's behavior.
And I would absolutely support that type of study because I think it's important to understand exactly what the mechanism is What we can say is it seems like the reintroduction of wolves does change kind of the distribution of deer within a county, and maybe it pushes them away from roads. But we do need more studies to really understand what this behavioral effect looks like.
UW-Madison economist Corbett Granger explaining a study he worked on that measures the economic benefits of wolves as predators, specifically preying on deer, reducing the number of deer car crashes. We'll be back. We'll talk more here in just a minute on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection, if you will, of evidence that there are economic benefits for wolves preying on deer in Wisconsin and reducing the number of car crashes. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the State Transportation Department, there are roughly 20,000 deer crashes a year. The study published last summer caught the attention of Late Night with Seth Meyers, and it made his news of the week. And so, come on, we have to listen to the clip.
According to a new study, relocating wolves to areas with frequent car accidents caused by deer can reduce collisions by 24%, which almost makes up for the 3,000% increase in wolf attacks.
Ba-dum-tsh. UW economist Corbett Granger with us on the study. Corbett, I'm thinking that that was either your look, Ma, I've made it moment, or the Academy is going up in flames.
You know, this paper was picked up by a lot of media, and that was probably the highlight for me. Yeah.
Well, when I was on your research page, I just gingerly clicked on it, and I was like, because, you know, it's all the usual suspects, New York Times, Washington Post, and then I like, Seth Meyers? Should I really be clicking on this? Well, let's take another call now. Bob is joining us near Superior. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Does your economist that we support with taxes up here in northern Wisconsin understand what hunting heritage is?
So, Bob, what are you asking specifically?
Well, you started touching on it. Why don't you let hunters do it?
Oh, I see.
Do you know what it's like? Does he know what it's like to have a dog? You live up here. You're constantly your own dog, poodle or whatever. You're in constant worry when he gets out at night that the wolves are going to attack the darn thing.
Bob, you bring up a really good point. Corbett, go ahead.
No, I completely sympathize with that. The predation on livestock and pets is something that that we obviously need to be cognizant of. But if we kind of take all of those losses and add them up, it still looks like the economic benefits of having wolves would probably dwarf all of those losses. It's not to say that those losses aren't real and important, and hopefully we could come up with some sort of way to protect those animals and come up with compensation schemes, but it doesn't kind of change the magnitudes of our findings.
Because the raw numbers really can't calculate in the emotional impact as well.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, economists have tried to put numbers on all sorts of losses, including these types of, you know, more emotional losses, trauma. There are ways to try to add those in. Our study doesn't do that. Our study kind of takes the market value of livestock as the cost associated with it. But there's certainly trauma. But my guess is that even if we factor those things in, that it wouldn't change the magnitudes that much.
Let's go to Paris now in Muskego. Hi, Paris.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, yeah, my question is, if your primary endpoint is reducing automobile accidents with wildlife, specifically deer, you know, I feel like primarily what we've done is we've created roads in what traditionally used to be, deer territory. So what's the efficacy of, I've read about other countries doing like wildlife bridges on especially on heavily trafficked roads that safely allow wildlife to go from one side to the other side. What's the efficacy of that in heavily trafficked areas? Because I feel like, you know, one of the potential problems with reintroducing wolves is now you have wolves and deer that it could potentially be crossing the street and you know, we could be hitting them. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
Paris, thank you. Corbett.
That's a great question. And if you look at other countries, you know, I spent a lot of time in Northern Europe and in Scandinavia. If you drive through Sweden, one thing that you'll notice is kind of along the main highways, very high fences on either side to keep moose and elk off of the roads. And then these corridors that are basically overpasses for wildlife. So those are very effective, but they're also very costly. Sweden is a relatively sparsely populated country. There aren't that many roads that they need to do that for. And I think that if we tried to do that for all of the highways and then even the county roads here in the state, that would end up being a pretty costly solution.
Hmm.
There are some other, you know, techniques beyond just kind of fencing enclosures, overpasses, or kind of habitat modification, things like fertility control, that are also very expensive and not very effective. Hunting is one, but hunting is kind of, you know, taken a downward turn. And in terms of participation in the state, the number of hunters and the number of hunting days has been going down since about 1982 in the state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, thinking of alternatives to try to kind of mitigate some of these losses and keep deer populations in check, bringing in apex predators is certainly something that looks more cost effective.
We're talking with Corbett Granger, who's an economist at UW-Madison, studies environmental and resource problems as we look at wolves and deer car collisions. You can join in your observations, 800-642-1234. Another interesting piece of this is how could your ecological calculus affect not just wolves and deer collisions, but other things that cause injury and death, like Lyme disease and parts of the ecosystem that keep things that hurt us at bay?
Absolutely. So there's an old quote from Aldo Leopold, one of kind of the first kind of conservationists in the state. Big fan of his work. He had a quote that said, just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. So there's a lot of damage caused by deer beyond, you know, deer vehicle collisions, which is what we look at. There's damages to crops, there's forests, there's the spread of Lyme disease and chronic wasting disease. And if you add up those damages, it adds another $30 billion per year nationally. So on top of the $10 billion in deer vehicle collision costs.
Wow. What is the next step for the research?
You know, that's a good question. I think what we need to know is more about the mechanism, and that's kind of outside of my wheelhouse. So I'm hoping that some ecologists can come in and do some other studies that can tell us, you know, what exactly is generating this effect. And I think, you know, if we're interested in kind of the political calculus and thinking about policies, one thing that that we need to think more about, and this comes back to the call from Bob, is the damages that that we get from wolves. You know, they're pretty concentrated. It's limited to people that live in those areas that may lose a pet or live in fear of losing a pet or livestock. The benefits of wolves are more diffuse. It's spread more evenly across the population. And if you look at, you know, and if you think about some of the other benefits of wolves, a lot of it is existence value, and it's kind of a non-use value where people do value knowing that this species is out in the wild. That's something that's harder to put a number on. But one thing that makes this a challenging issue is that the costs are kind of concentrated, the benefits are more diffuse, and so we need to think more carefully about, you know, how to compensate those who are dealing more directly with the costs of having wolves.
Along those lines, I did look at the DNR's wolf depredation report from last year and counted a little over 100 animals classified as probable or confirmed wolf depredation, and their report so far one this year. But, you know, the vast majority of these reports are on beef cattle or beef calves. We're almost out of time, but your observations there.
That confirms what I've seen, too. The number, again, I keep coming back to this, but the number of losses from wolves are pretty small relative to the magnitudes that we're looking at with these avoided deer vehicle collisions and these other, these other indirect benefits that wolves bring.
Corbett, thank you for joining us and explaining the research.
Well, thanks for having me.
Corbett Granger, Associate Professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. We have a link to the research article on wolves. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, we look at antitrust law. Are you worried about bid rigging, price fixing, or big companies swallowing up lots of smaller ones? News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the future of antitrust laws and what it means to have monopoly power in this country. On The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The likes of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, to name a few, have faced a number of lawsuits in recent years from the Justice Department, from the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, from attorneys general, all trying to root out monopoly power and dominance. How do you expect the rise in corporate mergers will affect your daily life? Can you make connections to inflation that we're seeing? 800-642-1234. Attorney Wendy Ahrens is Madison partner at Hush Blackwell, working on antitrust and competition litigation. Wendy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Kate. Nice to be here.
Well, I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, I suppose, started wondering about the roots of the word antitrust and where it came from. And it turns out in the 1800s, John D. Rockefeller lumps together a bunch of different businesses under the same group of, air quotes, trustees to gain more central control. And then the word trust came to be used to refer to these large companies or groups of companies. And surely you have more nuance, but how do you like to explain antitrust law and what it is?
Yeah, great question. And I think your rabbit hole has given you some great insight into the genesis of antitrust law generally. But currently, they prohibit unlawful mergers and certain business practices, and they're really very broadly worded. So the Sherman Act that was passed in 1890 was the first federal law that outlawed practices that were harmful to consumers, such as monopolies, cartels, and trusts. And over the years, because of the very broad nature of the statute, courts have really been left to decide which conduct is illegal based on the facts of each case. And courts have done so. And also, I might add, the federal agencies, along with state AGs, have applied the antitrust laws over the years in the face of these changing markets. And so, you know, antitrust laws have generally had the basic same objective over, you know, the past 100 years or more.
It's interesting you say that, because in these mega mergers, it seems it's often district court judges who are in the heart of the litigation, either allowing or stopping a merger from going through. And of course, attorneys general in the mix, too, with appeals. But can you reflect on what role judges and courts are having in deciding the state of corporate competition in America?
Well, no doubt they've played an integral role. And certainly, you know, they've had to apply the Clayton Act, which is the statute that applies to, in addition to the Sherman Act, which applies to illegal mergers and acquisitions. And so certainly courts have really, really helped to shape the law in terms of what's an illegal merger or acquisition. But also, as I mentioned before, antitrust agencies, both the U.S. Department of Justice, their antitrust division, as well as the Federal Trade Commission and state attorneys general, have also shaped, you know, what is considered an illegal merger or acquisition. They issued joint guidance. The federal agencies issued joint guidance for the business community to provide some transparency and some certainty as to how, you know, the agencies would enforce the Clayton Act and Sherman Act against mergers and acquisitions.
And it's a bigger tent than just mergers and acquisitions. There's like bid rigging and price fixing and then resale price maintenance. It seems to be there's a lot out there to regulate.
Oh, sure. Aside from mergers and acquisitions, the Sherman Act covers the per se or automatically illegal offenses where, you know, the fact of the agreement itself between competitors regarding prices, regarding bid rigging, regarding market allocation, those are considered kind of the most egregious offenses and, you know, can be criminally prosecuted. There's also the Sherman Act Section 2, which outlaws or prohibits monopolization or attempted monopolization and conspiracy to monopolize. And certainly, within the Clayton Act, there's the Robinson-Patman Act, which prohibits price discrimination. So there are a number of statutes at issue here that regulate businesses and their conduct.
And we often maybe rush to conclusions, or if we're not in the mix of the litigation, but we think mergers are bad. There are times, though, when mergers can benefit the consumer to offer services at a lower price than if two companies didn't merge, if they remain separate businesses. What is the side of mergers that you see that maybe we don't hear about as much?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, a lot of times companies are looking to combine in some way because they'd like to bring a new product to market. They see that they will be able to realize certain benefits or efficiencies from the acquisition or merger that then can be passed on to consumers. So absolutely, that plays a big role and is part of the analysis that's undertaken both by the federal agencies and the state AGs, as well as courts.
We're talking with Wendy Ahrens, who is an attorney looking at antitrust issues, a Madison partner at Hush Blackwell. You can join in. What are your thoughts on how the Biden administration is handling mergers and acquisitions? Do you think antitrust policy should be updated for the tech era? What about Silicon Valley? 800-642-1234. Let's move into more of the tech space and mergers and acquisitions in the area of, like, Microsoft, for instance, this month announcing plans to buy Activision Blizzard for nearly $69 billion, making it the third largest gaming company in the world. What kind of antitrust scrutiny should Microsoft expect there?
You know, I've heard it reported that, you know, they should expect some scrutiny by either DOJ or the FTC. So in the U.S., certainly the deal will receive some type of antitrust scrutiny. And I also expect that there will be other jurisdictions looking at the proposed transactions, such as the EU and potentially China, among others.
Another narrative out there is that our antitrust enforcers are soft, that the FTC is too lax, that, you know, they're not going hard enough at these companies such as Facebook. But do you think antitrust merger enforcement has declined in our country? What's going on?
I don't think it's declined, and I don't think it's soft or lax based on what I've seen. Certainly, there are the deals that receive scrutiny. That scrutiny is a long, intensive process and involves a lot of resources expended by all parties involved. I don't think there's a lack of scrutiny of mergers and acquisitions, certainly.
So when you look at Silicon Valley, and we've seen really a lot of tension with Congress saying we have to reform antitrust law, it is out of date or it is not working. What are your reactions when you watch those proceedings?
Well, I should say I'm not a competition policy scholar, but certainly it's interesting to watch as a practitioner. And again, I come back to the issue that we've seen actually in recent days with the wild swings in the stock market. I mean, businesses and their investors appreciate certainty in terms of any sort of regulatory regime and enforcement mechanism. If the antitrust laws end up, you know, being amended or, the regulations are changed or the guidelines, which we're just rescinded or being reviewed by DOJ and the FTC are changed, you know, this will cause some disruption in the market, and it may have some unintended consequences. So we'll just have to see how that plays out.
What might those unintended consequences be?
I really, you know, really can't speculate on that, but I would just say that, you know, there are a lot of tools currently at the Biden administration's disposal in terms of, you know, their ability to regulate and enforce the antitrust laws against, you know, big tech, if you will, among other industries. I mean, certainly the Biden administration has come out with a competition policy order back in July, and it not only talked about the technology industry, but it also talked about other industries such as agriculture, transportation, healthcare, banking and finance. So they're really looking at all sectors of the economy.
All sectors, yes. So as you mentioned there, President Biden issues this executive order asserting the administration's authority to regulate corporate consolidations. How do you see President Biden's antitrust views comparing to previous presidents?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's interesting because, you know, for the most part, with respect to presidential administrations, you know, antitrust law and the policy around it doesn't usually change all that much.
Hmm.
I mean, there does seem to be a tradition of the executive branch where, you know, they utilize their antitrust enforcement resources in a manner that aligns with political priorities. So, for example, with the Trump administration, you know, there were some allegedly politically motivated investigations into the cannabis and auto manufacturing industries. And here, you know, Biden has pronounced himself as, you know, a populist. He would like to, you know, be seen as obviously working on behalf of the consumers and ensuring that, you know, they're getting a fair shake. And how he does that, you know, through his competition policy order, which, you know, is directed not only at the antitrust agencies, but also at a number of federal agencies. So he's looking at a number of different tools in his toolbox in order to achieve what he's set out in his competition policy order.
Attorney Wendy Ahrens works on complex antitrust and competition issues arising during mergers and acquisitions. What do you think about big tech consolidating the gaming industry? How do you feel about the Biden administration's position on antitrust concerns? Will Congress pass a sweeping antitrust package? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Wendy Ahrens here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The chair of the Federal Trade Commission, Lina Khan, talked with CNBC last week about enforcement capabilities under her watch. And she gave this example of how the Biden administration is connecting market power to the inflation.
Certain types of mergers and acquisitions over the last few decades have left our supply chains much more brittle. Right? Capacity has been thinned out. And as a result of that, the system as a whole might be less resilient.
So she said when you have shocks like this pandemic, that can lead to certain price increases. Do you see broader issues with monopoly power? What antitrust bills in Congress are you watching? Does the FTC have teeth taking on Facebook? 800-642-1234. Antitrust attorney Wendy Ahrens with us for about five more minutes. So, Wendy, when you hear Lina Khan there looking more broadly at how inflation can be connected to antitrust and monopoly power, what do you make of that?
I think it's certainly, you know, one position. I think that there are, you know, certain folks out there who are skeptical of the causal connection. And, you know, I think even Biden's own administration, there have been some Treasury Department officials who have, you know, gone on the record to kind of say that they're not sure that there actually is that causal connection between market concentration and the current state of inflation. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there are a lot of other things going on in recent years that have led up to this point. And I'm not sure that we can connect the dots between the consolidations that has been occurring and has occurred over decades in various industries with the current inflation. There are other tools also to combat inflation. And so, you know, raising prices in and of itself is not illegal under antitrust law. Unfortunately, there's no federal price gouging statute. There are price gouging statutes at the state level. So, you know, there's no tool in the toolbox, so to speak, that would directly speak to, you know, price gouging at the federal level.
I see. Yes. And you said earlier that the FTC is not too lax, that its enforcers are not soft. But last year, former Federal Trade Commission Chair Joseph Simons and other staffs, they resigned en masse. How could staffing shortages at you know, our nation's regulatory agency affect antitrust oversight?
Certainly, you know, there have been reports of staffing shortages and, you know, the FTC being under-resourced, mm-hmm. Which, you know, could lead to, I would imagine, certain decisions at the FTC about which cases to pursue and which ones, you know, they don't have the resources to pursue. But again, you know, all of that's just speculation in terms of, you know, how the staffing shortage is affecting their enforcement. They certainly seem to be, the FTC does, taking on cases that, you know, before we have not seen them historically taking on. So for example, just a couple of days ago, it was announced that the FTC is suing to block Lockheed Martin's acquisition of a missile component producer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, traditionally, the DOJ's antitrust division would be the agency to review that case. So if the FTC is really, you know, that under-resourced, it's strange to me that they would be the ones to be suing to block Lockheed Martin's acquisition and not DOJ.
Besides Lockheed, you know, what cases are you watching most closely and why are you watching those cases?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of, you know, I think deals that are potentially under review that it's just not been made public. Mm-hmm. But certainly Amazon's, you know, acquisition of MGM is one. We're also watching, you know, the tech cases closely. We're certainly watching what is going on in the healthcare space. The Federal Trade Commission is very active in, as our state AGs, in enforcing antitrust laws in terms of healthcare systems that combine. And, you know, so those are the ones that I'm watching. I'm sure there are others, you know, in addition to the Microsoft proposed acquisition of Activision, that others are watching. And we'll just have to see. I mean, the cases where the FTC or DOJ is potentially going to review the deal under a set of guidelines called the vertical merger guidelines, mm-hmm. are interesting ones to watch, because the vertical merger guidelines, typically, you know, deals where companies are coming together, there's actual overlap between products or services, those are reviewed under the horizontal merger guidelines. And that's kind of a more tried and true analysis. The vertical merger guidelines are where companies who are at different levels of the supply chain, generally speaking, come together. And, you know, the Activision acquisition seems to be one of those that would fit under the vertical merger guidelines. Now, both DOJ and the FTC recently announced that they're reviewing jointly both sets of guidelines. So we'll have to see, you know, with respect to these vertical deals, you know, what standard are they going to use to analyze these deals? And are they going to use some sort of non-traditional analysis?
Well, Wendy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Wendy Ahrens, antitrust attorney and Madison partner at Hush Blackwell. More than 10,000 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID. This month's spike in infections saw more Wisconsinites hospitalized with the disease than at any time since the pandemic started. And this week, WPR is sharing stories of how the pandemic has been felt by Wisconsinites in their own words.
My name's Jackie Cutts, and I currently live in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I worked frontline from a public health standpoint on pandemic response for 2020 and all through 2021. You work all the time and you think about it when you're not working, and it was kind of this all-encompassing thing where you just want to help people and save lives and try to guide the community through this really intense, awful experience, but then find that the very people you're trying to help, some of them are the people who don't just not want help, but they hate you for it. I still have no regrets, and I'm fiercely proud of the work that I did with my team in 2021. But there's only so many times you can, you know, be swore at and yelled at and called names and receive death threats. You know, there's only so much of that before it kind of starts to wane on you, even if you know that what you're doing is the right thing.
My name is Kyle from DeForest, Wisconsin. I live with my wife and my 2-year-old daughter. When the pandemic began, we did only want to see people outside. So we were outside on our patio. My wife and I had chairs on one side with our daughter, and my mother and my stepfather were on the other side. And that, I'm sure, was very heartbreaking that she couldn't hold her granddaughter. She didn't want to wear a mask. My mother and my sisters like to live their lives as if COVID-19 isn't really happening. So every time that we visited since then, it was the same thing. We have to be outside. And that was fine until the winter months hit. At that point, the vaccines were just coming out. And I was so excited. But then after talking to my sister, my mom decided, no, we're too hurt. We haven't seen our granddaughter or niece in 6 months. We don't think you're ready. And I couldn't believe it. I knew I was causing pain, but I just didn't know how hurt they were.
My name is Marita Stolenwerk. I have 3 children, a 5th grader and 2 4th graders, and I currently live in Brookfield, Wisconsin. During the pandemic, I was a consultant for a national firm, and when I heard that we were going to lock down, I went to go talk to my manager, and I cried. I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this and have the kids at home. I remember I was rehearsing to give a presentation with my colleagues, and my daughter sat behind me and screamed because she needed my help before she could submit an assignment, and I couldn't help her because I was busy. So in December of 2020, I decided that I would apply for another opportunity. And I felt very conflicted about leaving the position that I was in. I had worked really hard to be at that position, but I felt like I was failing in so many ways. It was a little bit of a pay cut, but it is more manageable in terms of me being able to be engaged with my family.
Some people interviewed for this story shared their experiences with WPR's Wisconsin. WPR's series on the pandemic's effect on Wisconsinites continues tomorrow. Just ahead, we hear from an expert on Latino politics. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.